The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. You're joining We the People Radio with Aaron Ryan, Bill Cundiff, and
Bob Martin.
I had to be Aaron and Bill because Bill got stuck parking the car. Oh, he's back. We had to switch parking spaces. You know, you start in the yellow and it's all over but the ticketing. It's Sunday, though. Do they still ticket?
Not on Sundays.
Oh, darn it. Could have left it alone.
Not in our neck of the
woods. Here we were compelled to be, you know, law-abiding citizens.
Of course, you're familiar with the show Parking Wars, right?
No, but I think we were having it out front.
Well, that's based in one of the places it's based is Philadelphia.
Oh, well, our friends in Philadelphia then know what you're talking
they
about.
They know all about parking wars.
Well, here we go. Got Bill's computer up and running so he can join us. We have Hamid Azimi on the phone with us. We're actually much more organized than it sounds. And, you know, we hear so much about the Iran deal. And whether it's good or whether it's bad, and that all those guys are chanting death to America and blah, blah, blah. And I got an email the other day that was from the Iranian American community of Northern California. And as I read through it, I thought, hey, wait a minute. These guys sound like people that they sound like us. And, you know, you always know you're not getting the full story, but I really wanted somebody to tell us the story who could give us an unbiased view and give us a look at this deal that we keep hearing about, although much of it is secret. So we're not necessarily going to talk about the Iran deal, but we're going to talk about what's going on in their country and lots of things that I'll bet you most people didn't know. So, Hamid, I'm going to let you tell people what you would like them to know. I've listed your Facebook page, your Twitter page, that you are a human rights activist, and a secular republic is at reach, and we need to give the Ayatollahs the last push to get rid of them. I love that part. I put that right on the top. And links to your events, I guess we should bring that up too. We'll talk more about those, but they have a rally in New York, September 28th, so that's coming up in a few days, and in Berkeley. This group is actually based out of Berkeley. On August 29th at 6 o'clock, you can hear the untold story of the 1988 massacre by the Iranian regime. So they spend a lot of time killing their own guys, and there are tons of people in Iran opposing this leadership that don't want to go to war with us. So I guess that's like the quick snippet of what we're going to chat about. And then those are all the details I know, so now I'll stop talking. All right, Hamid, where would you like to start?
Good afternoon to you, Aaron and Bill, and to Bob and to all of your listeners. I sincerely appreciate you providing me this time so that I can talk about Iran and human rights in Iran and what the Iran deal is going to mean for all of us, to you and your listeners. So as you mentioned, I am a member and communications director for the Iranian American Community of Northern California. As it has been stated on our website and documentation for many, many years now, we are a group of Iranians that want to be the voice of the oppressed people of Iran here in the United States. We want to be their voice here. And what we are after, as you so clearly mentioned, is a secular republic in which we are going to abide with all international laws and norms, all the covenants that have been approved by the United Nations for human rights, women's rights, minority rights. We are against death penalty, and in such we are with no doubt against all of the policies of or all of the executions that are going on in Iran right now. As you and I talked earlier on the phone for a little while, and I mentioned to you about the abysmal situation of human rights in Iran and the last three decades that our nation has been at war with our government, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Ayatollah's regime, which is no republic, no Islamic, nothing. It's just a clear religious dictatorship that is getting its guidelines from many centuries ago and has no place in common history and the current history that we live in. This regime, over the last 30 years, has executed over 120,000 political prisoners. I'll repeat that, 120,000.
Oh, my gosh. Who qualifies to be executed? What do you have to do? You know,
anything starting from 30 years ago, Aaron, anything that had any signs of opposition to the religious dictatorship that considers itself the arm of God on earth and it considers itself the messenger of God and whatever they say and do is the rule of what God wants on earth. And that is what they use as the basis of anything that and anyone that opposes them. They have the term of calling them enemy of God on earth, which requires no trial, no jury, and the punishment is execution. And anybody who opposes the supreme leader and doubts the leadership of the supreme leader, which was Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the person who actually started the religious dictatorship in Iran after the fall of Shah, and now his successor, Khamenei, who is the person who has been behind all of the policies, including the Iran deal right now. Go ahead, please.
I'm sorry. What is the percentage of people that are in Iran that oppose this government? I mean, are you a small faction, or is it the majority of people over there that are just afraid to speak out?
It is absolutely the majority. Now, keep in mind that you're talking about a religious dictatorship that has more than three people hanging every day the last couple of years that this Rouhani has been placed in the president. So we cannot have any open polls or such, but there are quite a lot of indications in terms of the rallies that take place. And again, keep in mind that when you have a state of terror going on, for each person that makes it to the street and chants death to the dictator, there are thousands who are afraid to come out. What we saw as the clear popular indication of what the people want was in 2008, where we had the massive uprisings in the street of Tehran and other cities in Iran, where thousands upon thousands of people came out and they started requesting change and they wanted to make sure that we have freedom and democracy instead of the religious dictatorship. And ironically, it was in the same time that people wanted to make sure that they get some external support, not in terms of military or any type of military action in Iran, but simply hearing that the world leaders are actually supporting the cause of Iranian resistance. And there are video clips on YouTube that you can hear people chanting in the streets of Tehran, "Obama, are you with them?" meaning the Ayatollahs, "or with us?" The chant is in Persian, "Obama, Obama, Ya Ba Una, Ya Ba Ma," which translates basically, "you're either with them, the Ayatollahs, or with us." So in that term, there was clear indication that there still is, although unreported in the mainstream media, that there are ongoing rallies, demonstrations, in different cities of Iran in different parts. And the majority of the people of Iran, which are under the age of 30, are Iran is a very young population, has a very young population. They do want democratic change. They do want to be able to have freedom of choice, freedom of expression, and be able to use internet for example, freely.
And we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, I just want a clarification. Aren't the people that are wanting change now the same folks that tossed out the Shah and wanted the Ayatollah to come back? I'm a little confused on that part, but we're going to take a quick break.
So we have to go back a little further. See, I told you we were going to do a lot of history because because we need
it. Sounds good to me.
Because we need it. I thought that your point was well made. 75%, I think I read on your website, 75% of the people in your country are under the age of 30?
That's correct.
Yeah, I guess when you keep killing everyone, the population gets younger and younger. That is, anyway, I'm excited to learn the rest of the story. We're going to take a quick break. Rejoin us in 2 minutes with Hamid Azimi. You are listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Tons of information there for you. Be right back. Name of the game. Everybody wants to rule the world. And if you can't rule the world, what the heck? Just beat up on your own people. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. You can find all our archives for the last, I don't know, back to 2010. We've got shows on almost everything. If you have ideas for programs, our emails and phone numbers and stuff are on there. And we'd love to get your ideas. All right, so we're on with Hamid Azimi. All right, Hamid, explain to us how we got from the Shah to this and who was in majority. We were talking in the chat room here just during the break that your country lost an entire generation of people during the Iran-Iraq war. So that explains.
That is definitely true. And let me just step back and explain that the Iranian people have had a history of wanting to achieve democratic stage for the last over 100 years. About 100 years ago, we had our constitutional movement in Iran that wanted to move the monarchy from whatever stage it was to a constitutional government. And then in 1950s, pardon me, we had the movement in Iran led by Mohammad Mossadegh, the prime minister of the Shah, that nationalized the Iranian oil industry. And he was a person that wanted to have democracy in Iran and wanted to change the form of the government. And unfortunately, his government was toppled by a CIA-backed coup d'etat in Iran. And later on, during Clinton years, the Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, offered the people of Iran an apology, which was, in my opinion, way too little and way too late. By the time we got into 1970s, I was a student in Iran, and I remember vividly the night that President Carter was visiting Tehran and talking to the Shah of Iran. He was referring to his monarchy and what he was doing as the island of stability in the Middle East. That's what President Carter, how he described the Iranian regime situation under the Shah in 1978. Less than 2 years after that, I believe it was 13, 14 months after that, our society has risen up against the Shah to the level that the Shah had to leave the country, and we had the change of regime in 1979. What ended up happening after that was basically the religious leaders in Iran, led by Khomeini, they hijacked our revolution. They hijacked our people's revolution that wanted to achieve democracy in Iran. We wanted a secular democracy. We wanted to be part of the international community. We wanted to have an end to the social injustices that were going on under the Shah. We wanted to end the police state that the Shah was using to rule the country. And we wanted to have all type of freedoms that everybody else in the civilized world was enjoying. Unfortunately, because of the situation of progressive political groups in Iran, which were all imprisoned by the Shah. And because of that, they did not have the type of presence that they needed to have in the society to lead the revolution in the right direction. The religious leaders, who were very strong in Iran, stole our revolution and established, after less than 2 years, what they call the Islamic Republic of Iran, with the goal of establishing the Islamic Caliph in the Middle East, the Islamic State, basically. So what Khomeini wanted to do after stealing our revolution was basically materializing what his type had wanted for centuries, which was Islamic State. And the Islamic State that they wanted to have was with the clear slogan that they wanted to spread the type of Islamic rule that they envisioned throughout the Middle East and throughout the world. And that is what was the inception of all of the export of fundamentalism that the Iranian regime started doing into Iraq, all the way to Syria and Lebanon, and from the other side to, you know, other countries in the Middle East and into North Africa and what have you. So in that term, all of these things that have been happening have been in the direct contrast and contradiction and conflict with what the Iranian people have desired. When I was talking about the uprising of 2008, that was again the voice of the Iranian people wanting to tell the world that this is not what we want. We want to get rid of these ayatollahs, and we want to establish democracy and freedom and secularism in our homeland.
So would it be safe to assume the folks that led the uprising in 79 and had their uprising hijacked by the Ayatollah, most of them are probably dead from the Iran-Iraq war? Would that be correct?
Quite a lot of them, unfortunately, did get killed in that war. There is not a single family in Iran that has not had somebody killed in that war, including my own family, where I lost a cousin, and other members of my family were injured in that war. And other than, you know, what was the result or the casualties of that war, what is really important, Bill, is for us to realize that the reason that war got started was because of what Ayatollah Khomeini was doing in terms of exporting his vision of Islamic State into Iraq. Back then, Saddam Hussein was ruling Iraq as a Sunni, and as, you know, a lot of people even say that he was not enforcing any type of religion in his rule. But Ayatollah Khomeini was banking on the fact that the Shia population in Iraq were ready to uprise against Saddam Hussein. So he was actually meddling in the affairs of the Iraqis and sending messages to the Iraqi Shia back then. Now I'm talking about, you know, this was in 1980 and 82, between 80 and 82. And so he was trying to establish his foothold and footstep in Iraq with the Shia population so that he can continue his path of exporting his brand of Islam into Jordan and Syria and Lebanon. And if you, you know, these countries that I am naming is basically, if you look at the map of the Middle East, from Iran to the left, you cross to Iraq, and then after that is Jordan, and then you have the clutter of Syria and Lebanon, and right in the left corner, Palestine and Israel with their conflict there. And the Iranian regime basically wanted to start from Iraq as the footstep that had the majority Shia population and move on and spread their terror into Lebanon and Syria. And unfortunately, they had a lot of success in doing that because the civilized world did not realize that this is what they are doing and this is what they are trying to achieve. And voices, you know, like mine over the last 30 years were not loud enough to alarm the people that needed to be alarmed, or the people who needed to be alarmed did not listen to the proper advice and did not do what they were supposed to do.
So I guess you could say, or is it correct to say, that as bad as Saddam Hussein was, he kind of kept a lid on the whole Islamic State movement?
I'm really not familiar with the details of how he was ruling his country, but what I can tell you with 100% confidence is that the Islamic State, in terms of what Khomeini started in Iran, had a lid on it because there was no place for it to flourish and spread. Now, after the 79 revolution, and because it was stolen by the Ayatollahs, we had a country like Iran with the very important geopolitical situation that it has, right, you know, about the Persian Gulf, with the majority of the oil for the entire world passing through the Strait of Hormuz right next door, controlled by Iran as a country. This country, you know, to the right of Iraq, to the left of Afghanistan, with conflicts that international community was involved in, this country ended up having a government that was spreading Islamic fundamentalism. State sponsorship of fundamentalism and terror was the biggest outcome of the hijacking of our revolution. We had a very strong country with a lot of resources, a lot of oil money, as a government sponsoring Islamic terrorism and Islamic fundamentalism throughout the region. That was the turning point that is still going on, and the world needs to realize that this is the fundamentally huge mistake that the world made in not realizing that this was a huge danger, and supporting the people of Iran to uproot these people and get rid of the Ayatollahs should have been and must be right now the main policy of the West.
Okay.
Yeah, see, there just is, there's quite a bit that we obviously don't hear.
No, we just don't. We just don't get it in our media. I mean,
no, we don't. And there's just so much going on. That's the thing.
Everybody's well, a lot of it too is the fact that you can't get news out of Iran. I mean, they have a pretty good lock on what comes out of there, don't they? I mean, we don't get to hear the other side.
Well, that's how you know. I mean, that's the number one job of a dictator, isn't it? Cut off communication.
And make
sure nobody can support you too, because if nobody can support you, well, you'll get hijacked or killed or just bottom line fail again. We need to take another really quick break. We are speaking with Hamid Azimi. He is the communications director of the Iranian American Community of Northern California, and so we're getting a story. I don't mean a make-believe story, but I mean we're telling the tale of what's really going on in Iran, the things that we don't see. And for the people that are panicking, thinking, are you guys supporting the Iran deal that's on the table now? Is that one guy in the chat room said, is that where you're going? It's like, no, that's not where we're going. So, sorry, spoiler alert, we're not going to the support of the Iran deal. But we'll explain to you why that is. We thought why was more important than a yes or no answer. Besides that, yes or no doesn't take 2 hours, and why does. So we'll be right back with you. Lots of information on the website, wethepeopleradio.us. That's kind of scary. Okay, because that's what we were talking about.
Yeah, I've got a. Whoops, am I there? There we go.
There you are.
I've got a question. They're talking in the chat about the difference between the Arab population and the Persian population in Iran, and are Iranians Arabs or Persians?
Well, because see, it says in the chat. Iranian is a made-up name by Arab invaders. It's like, aha. Okay, can you, demystify that for us, Hamid?
Well,
we're much dumber than you thought. You got to go back a long way.
Persia and Persian and how it turned to Iran does have a history, and I know there's a valid discussion there. But in the general concept of what the question Bill asked, Persians are not of Arab descent, so the language is different, the culture is different, and our background is from the era of the Zoroastrians in Iran more than 2,000 years ago, and the monarchies in Iran, starting with Cyrus the Great 2,500 years ago, started a nation in the Middle East that was from the get-go in favor of human rights and democracy. And a lot of listeners might not know that in the United Nations there is a little stroll of Cyrus the Great. It's a little clay stroll that is kept at UN, I believe. I believe it's there, and it is the first declaration of human rights in history made by the Persian Emperor Cyrus the Great.
And now and was he Arab?
No. When we go back that many years in history, you know, the nationalities and where people came from was totally different. But right now, I'm just trying to explain to the listeners with the little historical, expertise that I have that the Persians are from the era of, Cyrus the Great that established a monarchy in Iran, and the language was Parsi, which was not Arabic. It's, the roots of the languages are the same. If you can think about it, like, English and Spanish and French, that the roots are the same. Latin, the alphabets are the same, but throughout the history, the right now in our continent, the Spanish speaking and English speaking are of totally different, background because of the history that they have carried over. It's pretty much the same between Persians and Arabs, and, we have lived the countries that have been Arab speaking and Persian speaking, the main one, Iran, and part of Afghanistan. We have lived, alongside each other for many years, but how we identify ourselves is as Persian-speaking people and the people who are very proud of our cultural heritage, and to be very specific, in Iran, even after, what Ayatollahs are trying to do, our Nowruz celebration, which is the beginning of the new year. We celebrate the vernal equinox, the exact moment that the earth turns over and spring starts, as the beginning of our new year, which falls around March 20th, 21st, obviously based on the exact timing of the rotation of Earth. And that is the biggest celebration in Iran, and no matter what Ayatollahs tried to do to get people not to celebrate it, they did not succeed, and that celebration remains the major celebration for Iranians in Iran and all over the world. And that has no religious connotation or religious root. It's an absolutely 100% cultural event for Iranians going back to 2,000 years ago with Zoroastrians in Iran, which predates Islam by, I believe, 1.5 centuries.
Yeah.
So actually, 1.5 millennium, I should say, yeah. 1,500 years or so. So that is how we identify ourselves. Persians who are very, keen of our culture and our language, and we are not Arabic speaking. We do not necessarily celebrate any of the religious ceremonies or religious, days that are celebrated as, Muslims or Christians, even though even Christmas is celebrated by a lot of Iranians as we honor it. Other Muslim holidays like the birth of the Prophet is celebrated and we honor it, but again, we do not identify as a nation by any of those. We respect them, but what we do identify ourselves by as Persians who celebrate Nowruz, the beginning of spring.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Much like the United States, we are a Christian culture, but we're made up of many different religions.
You can be an American, but be a
you could be
Catholic, Jewish, whatever.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Absolutely. So, back to our discussion about what is going on in Iran right now. As I mentioned, we are dealing with a government that has over the last 30 years executed 120,000 people, and 30,000 of these people were massacred in the summer of 1988, and that is one of the main subjects of our program that is coming up this Saturday. We will be talking about that massacre of 30,000 people. We will have among us people who have survived that massacre. One of our speakers was among people who was in prison the last few months of, you know, that massacre. She was arrested when she was 15 years old in Tehran for supporting the main opposition group, Ayatollahs, which is a organization called People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran. She was arrested for supporting PMOI, People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, and she was given a sentence of 5 years, ended up being in prison for 8, and witnessing, you know, what happened in prisons and how a massive number of people were executed in that summer.
Can you and give us a little snippet of what precipitated that? What, you know, what brought all that on in 88?
Absolutely. It was ironically toward the end of the Iran-Iraq war. And, you know, Khomeini's regime, Ayatollah's regime, had started that war and wanted to take over Iraq and make it a footstep for their Islamic State that they wanted to build. And because of different factors, including the fact that, you know, they had to deal with the mainstream opposition group that was gaining momentum, and, you know, no matter how many people the Ayatollahs imprisoned and killed, the opposition group, the PMOI, was gaining strength, and the Ayatollahs realized that they are not going to be able to fight in both fronts, internally and externally, and they were losing momentum in the war against Iraq, and the UN resolutions were coming one after the other asking for a ceasefire. So at a point, Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the supreme leader back there, decided that he is going to eliminate all of his enemies internally in prison, and then end the war and, you know, have international pressure lifted from him, and at the same time, you know, eliminate his opposition. So in the last few months leading to where the Ayatollah accepted the UN ceasefire and ended the war, We have a lot of witnesses, including our speaker, that will attest that there was a movement within the prison system in Iran to eliminate all of the people who were steadfast in opposing the Ayatollahs. So he was basically gathering everybody, setting the stage to start the killing. And it was a very, you know, fast and quick process that the Ayatollahs were going through. They were basically just getting a panel of three judges and bring the prisoner in and ask them one simple question. Are you still a supporter of the PMOI, and are you going to stay that way? And if the answer was yes, I'm doing that, then the penalty was execution, and it was carried out very quickly. And there are a number of writings by Khomeini himself that suggest to these judges that they should carry out the sentence in the quickest way possible and do not be afraid of any reprisal, and just do what is supposed to be done. And it was in that era, in that atmosphere, and in that environment that the Ayatollah regime decided to get rid of all of these prisoners and it was, again, very ironic that it was under an international pressure that they gave in to the will of international community and the opposition groups that were working against them to stop a war. So they immediately, you know, started killing opposition in Iran. And unfortunately, that's what we are seeing right now, that as they are giving in to the international pressure, the number of executions in Iran is going up to the point that the last few weeks, Amnesty International has basically called it an unprecedented spike in executions. And the UN Special Human Rights Rapporteur to Iran has also, in his last report, said that, you know, the trend of and the situation, the human rights situation, has worsened in Iran. So, just finishing up the answer to your question, that was basically the setup that the Ayatollahs wanted to get rid of the opposition. The stage was set after accepting the ceasefire, and then they went ahead and they killed a massive number of people in the tune of 30,000 and more in prisons in Iran.
Wow. You know, nothing like letting everybody have their say. Good grief. If you take them all out, I guess they can't oppose you. But, you know, it's an interesting thing. People don't, they don't stay down forever. And we need to chat more about your opposition, because it's led by a woman. And so for those people that think that, I don't know, I mean, that was news to me. And a lot of people don't think women have any rights. Well, you have an entire opposition movement run by a lady. And on the website, you can see the video. There's a great video of her with Rudy Giuliani and a bunch of people from former congressmen and senators. So there are people in this country who know about it. They just don't wind up on the front page of the news. We're going to come right back with Hamid Azimi. We are going to speak with him the second hour as well. So we'll have just a few minutes when we come back this hour, but we hope you'll hang out with us. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Doesn't kill you, makes you stronger. Stand a little taller. Doesn't mean I'm lonely when I'm alone. What doesn't kill you, makes you brighter. What does keep you lighter? Doesn't mean I'm over, 'cause you're gone. What doesn't kill you, makes you stronger.
Kind of a good song for that. Okay, so Hamid, we've just got a couple minutes here to the top of the hour, but what happened after the people were all executed? Do they have such a tight control on communication? Is that why we don't hear much of what happens?
Yeah, was there an uprising at that point? I would think that the population would have revolted.
Well, the population, you know, as you go through changes in your struggle as your enemy, which in our case is Ayatollahs, takes an action and takes out a lot of people in terms of executing them. The reason they do it is they want to have a atmosphere of fear and intimidation ruling the country. And obviously at different times they succeed to have that atmosphere prevail what is being done in the country. But
sure,
because of the nature of our nation, because of, as I mentioned, the fact that we have a history of more than 100 years of struggle to achieve this democracy, and because, as you mentioned, Erin, we do have an organized resistance led by a woman, Mrs. Maryam Rajavi, they really did not succeed in, you know, putting all of the fires down. The biggest fire that is burning is the leadership of a woman fighting the Islamic fundamentalists. Now, keep in mind that when you are fighting an entity, you got to realize what is the biggest element that defines and describes this entity. In terms of the Ayatollahs and the Islamic fundamentalists, their objection to freedom of woman is their biggest identifier. More than anything, they are against women's freedom. More than anything, they want to put down women.
Hold that thought, Hamid. Sorry, we were tardy on our breaks and we got jammed up here at the end. We will start fresh at 5 after, and we'll start on that point, because that's a big one, and that's a story we haven't been told. We're here with Hamid Azimi, the communications director of the Iranian American Community of Northern California. They've got events in New York on the 28th, September 28th, and here in California, August the 29th. So anyway, that's all online. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Welcome back. You are joining We the People Radio. There we go. Our sound is a little goofy. All right. The first hour, we were chatting with Hamid Azimi from the Iranian Iranian American Community of Northern California. It's actually easier if I read it. We learned some history, because that's our biggest problem here. We either don't know the history or we know incorrect history. So we've gone backwards to try to figure out how to go forward with you. So in this second half, Hamid, it was funny, we were chatting the other day that, well, 2 hours, that's a long time. And I thought, oh, you have no idea how stupid we are about this.
And how fast time flies on radio.
And how quickly the time will go. So we did have somebody who had a question in here about Turkey fighting in the ISIS thing. Do you have any commentary on that at all?
I actually do, but
we got to go back to the women too. Sorry, yeah.
Well,
forgive me.
No, that's okay. I definitely want to get to the question that was raised, but I would really like to do, if you don't mind, a little modern history of Iran. And
you know, go for it.
Share with your listeners.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful.
Yeah, definitely. What everybody needs to realize, you know, is that the young generation in Iran, the Iranian society, as I keep on saying that, you know, it's been after democratic change in Iran for over 100 years. This society is a very live, vibrant society. And as, you know, throughout the past history, as even, you know, the Arabs took over and, you know, we were involved as part of the negotiations and, you know, what was going on in the World War II, you know, British forces south of Iran, you know, Soviet forces north of Iran, and our nation has gone through all of that. Our nation has seen, you know, the changes of a democratically elected Prime Minister Mossadegh being overthrown by a coup d'etat, and all of these are in our recent history of this very live, very vibrant society. And when the Ayatollahs hijacked on the anti-monarchy revolution in 1979, with the goal, our goal was to get rid of the monarchy and establish a secular republic in Iran. The Ayatollahs saw that, and as I was sharing with your listeners at the top of the previous hour, the biggest identifier of these Ayatollahs was their enmity with people, with women, forcing women to have, you know, the hijab or the veil that they have to wear, you know, putting it in their constitution and laws that they are not allowed to become president, they are not allowed to become judges, and quite a lot of other restrictions that are in the penal codes of the Ayatollahs. So it was very natural for Iranian nation as a whole to rise against this entity, and it was very natural for a woman to take the leadership because the most oppressed part of the society naturally ends up being the one that has a whole lot to fight for and naturally becomes the leader. And we are, as a nation, very fortunate that we have Mrs. Zardabi leading a group that is called the National Council of Resistance of Iran, which is a coalition of different entities that have got together under Mrs. Zardabi's leadership to empower people of Iran for regime change by the people of Iran and to establish a secular republic in Iran. What Mrs. Rajavi is promoting is totally against what the Ayatollahs believe in. You know, her commitments are to prevent any violation of any type of individual or social rights and freedoms in Iran. She's committed to abolish the death penalty in Iran.
Wow.
She has basically, along with the NCRI, the National Council of Resistance of Iran, the coalition, they have committed to all of the international covenants on the civil and political rights, you know, the UN covenants on elimination of all forms of discrimination against women and all of the relevant human rights covenants that are internationally known and recognized. And just the fact that, you know, she wants to promote the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is in total contradiction with the Ayatollahs and what they believe in. You know, they want to spread the Islamic retribution laws, and Mrs. Rajavi and her movement are completely against it. The Ayatollahs do not abide by any of these international covenants that touched on, and they want to, you know, make the world believe that there is such thing as Islamic law that they are allowed to spread in Iran and Middle East. And Mrs. Rajavi is completely against that, and she's committed to bring democratic change in Iran by the people of Iran.
And that brings up a really good point. If they don't agree with international law, how can we sit down and pound out an agreement with them when they're not gonna honor it?
Well, you make most of it secret.
Well, okay, yeah,
that's how you do it.
So you make an agreement, and then tell them they don't have to agree to it.
Yeah.
And they can
police themselves, by the way, because that's such a good idea.
Oh, definitely. You know, we can definitely talk about the agreement and how phony this agreement could be, and the whole issue of agreement. I think, if you don't mind, let me just finish up my thoughts on this human rights, and in the next segment we'll touch on the agreement. Just to go back to what we are actually fighting in Iran, this Islamic Republic regime, the anti-Islamic, a lot of people in Iran call it, because this is not something that people of Iran recognize as Islamic. They have been putting a lot of restriction on all sort of, you know, all type of different population segments in Iran, ethnicities, you know, minorities in Iran, and people of, you know, different beliefs, any type of dissent or any type of social difference that they see between what they believe and what people are wanting to do has been oppressed in Iran. We have all of the reports for this year, 2015, indicates that we have had at least 700 executions in Iran, and these are all have been going on during all of these Iran deal months of extensive negotiations, as they call it. So the West has closed their eyes on all of these. There are 74 types of tortures that have been going on in prisons in Iran. And we will be talking about some of them with, you know, witnesses that have gone through them in our event Saturday night. And this regime has been condemned by the UN General Assembly 61 different times in the last 30 years. 61 times for violation of human rights in Iran. But what is not really being done and what should be done is that the case of the human rights situation, the abuse of human rights, the condition of human rights, this case needs to be referred to the UN General Assembly for, and UN Security Council, I should say, for immediate action against these ayatollahs. Unfortunately, we are seeing something completely different and in a completely different direction. Instead of, you know, the U.S. government, our government here in this country, our second homeland as Iranian Americans, instead of our administration and government take the case of the human rights abuses to the U.N. Security Council, they are now taking the case of releasing sanctions on ayatollahs to the U.N. And what happens in case of Iranians and Iranian population is that the little pressure that has been on ayatollahs in terms of sanctions is getting lifted. As I mentioned in previous segment, when people come to the street and chant, you know, we want democracy, we want to get rid of the ayatollahs, and they ask Obama, are you with us or with them? They are actually calling for some sort of international support, not in terms of military support and start of another war, but in terms of just knowing that their voice is being heard and echoed and repeated outside the borders of the country. And this is something that I have firsthand experience with it. During the last months of the anti-monarchy revolution in 1979, every day that we had rallies in Tehran and in other cities, people like me and everywhere in the country would sit down. We would sit down in front of our shortwave radios at night, listening to international broadcasts like Voice of America and BBC, just to hear whether or not our voice has been heard and anybody is talking about it. And every night that we heard that the rallies and demonstrations, the anti-Shah demonstrations were echoed in any of these international radios, we would get more energy and more power to go out and demonstrate the other day. And right now that, in our current situation, that is something that is missing. Instead of, you know, the mainstream media and the administration echoing the will and aspiration of people of Iran that they are out in the streets and they want democratic change, instead of echoing that, to send the message to them that the youth in Iran, we hear you, we are behind you, and we are going to be your voice for your quest for freedom. Instead of doing that, we are, you know, we have our president going to the press conferences, and instead of mentioning anything about people's will and desire in Iran, instead of mentioning anything substantive about the abysmal situation of human rights in Iran, he is offering, you know, a regional power position to the ayatollahs. And it was very unfortunate for me to hear the president in two of his last speeches telling ayatollahs that you come and you make this deal and you will have your place in the Middle East as a regional power. It is absolutely unacceptable to us as Iranians and Iranian Americans to know that the uprising of the people in Iran is not getting supported, and the Ayatollahs, who are the godfather of ISIS, the godfather of the Islamic State, they are being given an opportunity to become a regional power.
So what do we do to change that? I mean,
hold on, we have to talk about that when we come back. I know it's so easy to just buzz through the breaks. We need to take a really quick break, thank our sponsors, and give Hamid a second to catch his breath. We're going to come right back with him, chat more about the situation in Iran, the real situation, not just what we see on the TV. Anyway, lots of information on the website. We hope you'll join us there, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll have an archive up in just a little while, and you'll be able to listen, send it to your friends. We'd appreciate that.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
Excellent choice, Bob. you're very clever today. You are joining We the People Radio. We are here with Hamid Azimi. He is the communications director for the Iranian American Community of Northern California. And they are an association of Iranians who believe that it's their responsibility to use the freedoms and power in the United States to be the voice of the oppressed people in Iran. What a great idea. They're against the theocratic regime of Iran, believe that Iran should be a democratic, secular republic. And these are all things that we just don't hear enough, Hamid. I'm sure I asked you the other day, when you watch the news, do you just sit there and throw your shoes out at the TV?
Well, sometimes you get the feeling that you want to be doing that, but,
Yeah.
The fact even remains that, For a society, for a nation to achieve what they want, they have to pay the price to get to their freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you look at the history in this country, America as a nation has paid its own price to get to where it is right now. And our nation, the Iranian nation, is not afraid of doing that. We are more than willing. And under the leadership of Mrs. Rajavi and the National Council of Resistance of Iran that we talked about, we are more than capable of doing that. Now, Bill was asking, if I'm not mistaken, about what should be done in terms of the policy. Let me just touch on a little recent history of what should not have been done and was done.
It's a good way to go.
For many years, the movement that I support, the National Council of Resistance, and its main opposition group, the PMOI, People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, were unfairly and unjustly tagged as a terrorist organization by the United States Department of State. It took our movement more than a decade to fight that issue through halls of Congress and the legal system finally. And the video clip that Aaron, that you were referring to, and the link is on your website, showing some very high level current and ex U.S. officials from both sides of the aisle, from Rudy Giuliani to Howard Dean, from General James Jones, which was the former National Security Advisor to President Obama, to Tom Ridge, who was the first Secretary of State for the United States, to to Louis Free, who was the former director of FBI, and Michael Mukasey, who was the attorney general for the 4th District in New York, if I'm not mistaken, and General Hugh Shelton, who was U.S. Army chairman of the Joint Chiefs of, Chiefs of Staff. They were all involved in the correction of this error made by the United States in shackling the Iranian opposition group and not allowing it to do its job. Now, we have passed that hurdle now, and, you know, there are residues of that label still available here and there in terms of false information, in terms of, you know, wrong policies and what have you. But at this point, now that we have gone through the so-called negotiations with the Ayatollahs and we really want to take the next step in knowing what to do, one of the biggest things that people need to realize right now is that there was a reason for the Ayatollahs to come to the negotiations table. Their illicit nuclear activities has never ever been, any part of it has never been disclosed by the Iranian regime. All of the components of the Iranian regime's nuclear activities has been exposed by the main Iranian opposition group, the PMOI. Starting from 2002, where the first site was, and the program of the Iranian regime's nuclear activities was explored in Washington, D.C., up until now, there has been over 100 cases of exposures done by the PMOI about the Iranian regime's nuclear activity. The sanctions that we saw was a direct result of these exposures when the international community was faced with the fact that we have this religious dictatorship in a very important geopolitical land in the world called Iran. They are building a bomb, an atomic bomb. Then, you know, little by little, the pressure, international pressure in terms of sanctions on the Ayatollahs started building up. It was under those sanctions and also under the threat of the Iranian young population pouring out to the streets again, like they did in 2008. It was under those conditions that the Iranian regime came to the negotiation table. So it wasn't from the, you know, position of strength. It was from a position of weakness. What also very clearly describes how weak this regime is in terms of dealing with the popular dissent is the sheer number of executions and public executions they are carrying out. You know, we can just, you know, very generally think about any government that has a position of strength and is not and does not need to make the population frightened. They don't need to carry out any kind of savage and mean, you know, form of punishment. They don't need to have public execution. When a regime does have public execution, more than anything, it shows that it's afraid of the people. It's afraid of the uprising of the people, and if the regime wants to scare the people. So there are all signs and indications that the number of executions shows that the Iranian regime is afraid of the uprisings. They were under the sanctions regime, and they wanted to get some relief to be able to buy more arms and do more bad in Iran and in the Middle East.
And by relieving the sanctions, does that help the executions or hurt the executions?
It would definitely hurt it. There's no doubt that it's going to hurt it, because right now, even right now, the news that came out of Iran just yesterday, I believe, the Iranian regime introduced a new missile that they have built. And the president of the Iranian regime, who is supposed to be the moderate and who is the the main, you know, party of the so-called negotiations that had been going on, very clearly started talking about how the his regime is going to keep on purchasing and selling these arms to what he called their friends in the Middle East, which is just code word for all of these terrorist groups that they support. And this action of him coming out and speaking like that, this was really in complete contradiction with the agreement that they are supposed to adhere to with the international community. And all of these remarks show, even right now, that they are not going to abide by any international norm. And that's why, you know, from the get-go, Mrs. Rajavi was the person who came out and said, okay, you want to make a deal with them and give them money? United Nations should have strict monitoring on the cash that is being poured into the hands of these mullahs, because we know that, you know, the money is not going to be spent on the urgent needs of the Iranian people. You know, the money is not going to be used to catch up the unpaid meager salaries that the workers and teachers and nurses are receiving. The money is not going to be used to provision food and medicine for the populace. And Mrs. Rajavi pointed out that this money, no doubt, is going to be used by the religious leader Khamenei on the Islamic Republic Guard Force, the IRGC, for their fundamentalist activities that they have in Iraq, they have it in Yemen, in Syria, in Lebanon. So that was the clear warning that Mrs. Rajavi made, and now we see that she was absolutely right, and the Iranian regime, the head of, you know, the state, President Rouhani, is clearly today talking about, or yesterday was talking about, how his regime is going to pour this money into selling arms to their friends in the Middle East.
Yeah, so that the old relief of sanctions is going to do exactly what we have been hearing, and that has been fairly widely publicized. We're going to come back in just 2 minutes with Hamid Azimi. You can join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Lots of good information there. Before we get off here too, Hamid, we've got to be sure and promote your two events that are coming up. I've listed the information on the website, but nothing like hearing it from the horse's mouth, as they say. So we will come right back with Hamid. You're listening to We the People.
Revolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright. Alright. I can't tell if some of bells are ringing, Roman Catholic choirs are singing. Missionaries in a foreign field. For some reason I can't explain. Once you've gone, it was never in all this world. That was when I ruled the world.
Welcome back to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. All the information about our guest, Hamid Azimi, and his group, the Iranian American Community of Northern California. Hamid, what have we missed since we've covered world history?
we have covered a lot, and as you and I talked before, there's a whole lot more to talk about. And right now, I'm just going to take your suggestion and talk a little bit about our events coming up. Our group in Northern California is having the event about the commemoration of the 1988 massacre or genocide of 30,000 political prisoners in Iran. The event is going to be this Saturday night at UC Berkeley's International House, White House, and as I mentioned before, one of our guests would be a survivor of that said execution. She was sentenced to 5 years in prison when she was arrested at the age of 15 by the Ayatollahs for the crime of supporting the main opposition group, the PMOI, People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran. She spent 8 years in prison, and she will be talking about her firsthand eyewitness account of what was going on in the prisons in Iran in the months that led to the massacre of 1988. In our event, we will also have Ambassador Bloomfield, who will be talking about Iran deal and our perspective of what we think as the right thing is to be done. And just to touch on that, Aaron, as we have talked before, our main concern about this deal is not whether or not, you know, this thing or that thing is going to go through. Our main concern is that this deal has been a weak deal. This deal does not close all of the avenues for the Iranian regime to shut down and, you know, be a nuclear-free Iran. As we have mentioned on our website, our desire and goal, and the desire and goal that has been stated clearly by Mrs. Maryam Rajavi, the leader of our resistance, the president of the National Council of Resistance of Iran, is to have a nuclear-free Iran. We have enough oil and gas reserves in Iran to last us for more than a century, if I'm not mistaken, but it's for many years. And we are fundamentally against the nuclear power because of the inherent danger that it has for population and for the environment. And we have seen unfortunate examples of that most recently in Japan, that this type of energy is really not safe. We have other ways, you know, especially in Iran, for harvesting energy from wind and from the sun with the vast number of areas that we have with capability of hosting farms of wind turbines and also for solar, harvesting the solar power in different areas. And also the Iran deal is going to lift the little pressure that sanction has on our enemy as Iranians, and it's going to help our enemy in Iran. One of the biggest selling points of this Iran deal has been the unreal, you know, horror and danger of the other alternative, which is war. Mm-hmm. The president keeps on just asking about, if we don't make this, there's going to be a war. And we want to make the point that, no, there has always been and there is a third option, which is regime change by the people of Iran. And if we make that our policy, if we empower people of Iran for regime change, if the U.S. administration, instead of not verbalizing that Ayatollahs must go, if we go back and look at the stated statements and policies of this and previous administrations, there has never been a call clearly saying that Ayatollahs must go. In the recent history, we have heard that about you know, Libya, we have heard that about other nations in the Arab Springs where the leaders of West, and especially the leaders in the United States, have come out and say, Gaddafi must go, who was the leader of Libya. We have never heard that stated policy. So back to what I said in the previous segment, what that does is that it does not give enough fuel, enough energy, enough ambition to the people in Iran who need to go out and demonstrate every day until they bring down the system. If you put your place in the shoes of people like me who used to go out and demonstrate and are going out, the younger generation are doing that. If they go out every day and they just don't hear anything about, you know, what the world is thinking about them, their opposition is going to diminish. In case of Iran, we have been extremely fortunate, as I mentioned, with the leadership of Mrs. Rajavi, that we've ended up with a thriving opposition. What we did not have a chance to talk about is, you know, the Iranians who were fighting these Ayatollahs, and through a very complicated history, they ended up being in a camp in Iraq. Right now, about 3,000 of them are in a camp called Camp Liberty in Iraq. And because of their opposition to the Ayatollahs, they have been under extreme pressure. They are under constant siege by the Iranian-backed elements in Iraq. And we have not been able to get the administration to put enough pressure on the Iraqi government to lift the pressure off of these Iranian refugees at Camp Liberty, Iraq. That is an ongoing struggle for us, and hopefully next time that there's a chance for me to talk to your listeners, we'll get more into more details about that. So all of these things are related to what needs to happen, what needs to be done by the international community, what needs to be done by the United States government. War is not the danger. The real big danger is getting to bed with the Ayatollahs and allowing them to become a regional power. The big danger is allowing them to continue funding ISIS as a movement that they are godfather of and they started.
So the whole idea that we should relieve the sanctions, sign the deal, and empower these guys does absolutely everything that's against the interest of the people in Iran, the people in the United States, and basically people in other countries too, I suppose.
I completely agree with you. If we look at the international scene and the biggest conflicts that the world is dealing with, the one conflict that has taken the nature of international magnitude is the fight against Islamic fundamentalism and what is called ISIS. And the point that is being missed in the middle of this is that the godfather of ISIS is the government ruling Iran. And that government ruling in Iran, if anybody just imagines that if that government is gone and is replaced by a secular republic that is not in the business of exporting terrorism and, you know, funding Hezbollah and Hamas all the way to Lebanon and, you know, sending their suicide bombers here and there, you know, sending roadside bombs to Iraq, if all of those elements are stopped by a regime change in Iran, by the people of Iran, we are going to be witnessing a totally different Middle East. And the world is going to be able to deal with this phenomenon of fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism, that has become a global threat for everybody in a much easier way. So we strongly believe that our cause in fighting the Iranian regime and making the regime change is in the interest of not only the Iranian people, not only the people of the Middle East, but as you mentioned, you know, people all over the world, including the United States. And on that note, I must just pitch what we are going to be doing in front of the United Nations Monday, September 28th.
Hold that thought, and we will finish up the hour with that. Okay, got to fit in.
Great.
Fit in one more short break here, and we're going to come back with Hamid Azimi. We are speaking about all things Iran today that are true. Imagine that, a little truth in your day. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're finishing up the second hour here at We the People Radio. So our last thing, Hamid, is the Organization of Iranian American Communities in the U.S. and the 2015 rally, September 28th in New York. Tell us about that.
Yes, indeed. So the Organization of Iranian American Communities is basically an umbrella organization for all of the local organizations like ours, the Iranian Americans in Northern California. That this umbrella organization covers all of us in all 40-some states that we do have active organizations. As it's our mission to be the voice of the Iranian people, we want to make sure that the world community understands that when people get together at United Nations in September for the General Assembly, the person who is representing Iran, which would be the President Rouhani, is not the representative of the Iranian people. That guy represents a oppressive, medieval, religious dictatorship that needs to be toppled, and the seat in UN needs to be handed over to people of Iran and their organized opposition. In our opinion, it needs to be turned over to the National Council of Resistance led by Mrs. Rajavi. But the bigger scope of things is that there are all indications that the General Assembly stage is going to be used to promote and seal up the deal that the West is trying to make with the evil Ayatollahs. And we want to be out there to oppose that as well and make sure that everybody understands that the United Nations arena should not be used to promote Islamic dictatorship in our homeland. So on that note, we are inviting everybody to join us in front of UN at 10:30 a.m. On Monday, September 28th, quite a few people from our community in Northern California, including me and my family, will be there on that Monday morning to be the voice of the people of Iran, to make sure that the world community hears our voice, that we want democratic change in Iran, we want nuclear-free Iran, we want a government, a republic with complete separation of church and state, We want an end to executions. We want an end to export of fundamentalism and terrorism throughout the region and world. And we want to abide by all the international norms and not what is called the Sharia or Islamic law. And this would be the main message of our rally. Quite a few people, dignitaries that have been in our previous events. Some of the video clips are on the website link that you have so kindly put on your website, on Bill. You can see that, you know, those dignitaries, most of them will be joining us in front of UN. It will be, as far as U.S. Internal politics is concerned, a bipartisan array of different dignitaries joining us, and the message will be one that will ask for regime change in Iran, with the outcome of all of these evil things that are going on will end, and it would be to the benefit of the people of the Middle East and to the benefit of the national security of the United States of America.
Well, I think that's awesome. And those are all the things that so many people have. I mean, I think we all kind of wondered about these things, but it's not what we hear. So we really appreciate you coming on this morning and unscrambling all of this. It's a complicated place. But for the folks who live on the West Coast, if you can get to Berkeley August the 29th, and there's a registration. Do they have to register for the event, Hamid? I know it's on there, but is that a must?
It's actually for both events. There are, you know, registration forms that would help us manage the event, especially for our next this coming Saturday. If they could sign up, it would help us a lot.
Okay.
If not, you know, they are more than welcome to join us.
All right, cool. Because there's we linked all your website and the registration form and all that, and then there's a big round circle that says 2015 rally, no to a nuclear Iran, yes to regime change by Iranians, for the September event. That'll take you to that page where you can get all the details. So for our folks in Philadelphia and New Jersey, if you're up in New York that day or you have friends, please send them, and we'd love to support you. Hamid, we hope to have you back again in the future so we can learn more things. So please reach
Sounds
out to
great.
Us.
Sounds great, and I thank you and Bill and especially Bob for all the Afro music that you played.
Yeah, he went overboard today. Thank you so very much, and if we get lucky, maybe we'll see you on August 29th.
Hopefully.
All right, join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Send the show to your friends so that they can learn about this too.
Yep.
See you next week, folks.
Thanks for listening, everyone.